Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Janet is so lucky, Mom, my 12-year-old whined. Because she just lives with her mom and dad both feel guilty, so she gets lots of really great stuff. How can single parents provide a balanced child-rearing environment and still maintain their sense of perspective? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today, our guests will give us their perspectives on single parenting. Dr. Venus Masalam is a psychologist and family therapist working with single parents. She is also the parent of two grown sons. Welcome, Dr. Masalam.
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here, both as a therapist as well as a single parent.
Ashley Doherty is an attorney who, as a single parent, is also the mother of Dorothy, currently a senior in high school. We're glad to have you with us, Ashley.
Thanks for inviting me, Linda.
Dr. Masalam, what possible behavior changes can beginning single parents expect to observe in their child?
What one frequently may encounter as a single parent is that children's behavior will regress to an earlier stage. For example, if you have toilet trained your child successfully and suddenly they start having accidents, again, don't be surprised, because it'll be important for you to realize that you are really starting again in the sense of establishing a solid base as a single parent. Schoolwork is also one of the areas that one can expect changes in. And that's why it's very important when there's a separation or a problem that you contact the school people and ask for help rather than waiting until they call you and say something's going on, what's going on.
And I assume different personalities of children will play themselves out in different ways. What, for example, if you had a more assertive child, what kinds of behaviors would you probably see? Would you see an exaggeration of that behavior, or would you see a kid who might withdraw totally?
It will totally depend on how they interpret what's happened. One of the major things one always wants to communicate to children is it's not their fault. Children who are assertive, I don't know if you're suggesting that perhaps they may get more aggressive, which can happen as well in terms of physical behavior towards other children, because they don't know what to do with the anger they're suddenly feeling and the frustration. They don't know where to go with it. Other children may all of a sudden become model children because they feel their bad behavior may have been the cause of what happened, and so that they will go to the other extreme and feel that they have to really do well in school and put a tremendous amount of pressure on themselves.
I noticed that happening in my daughter's life. Her father died when she was 7, and by a very bizarre coincidence, the father of a boy in her first grade class had also died that same year. The two children reacted in very different ways. The boy reacted by acting out and becoming extremely aggressive. My daughter became the model good girl because she wanted the approbation and approval of the teachers at school. One problem for the two children is the way my daughter reacted meant she got lots of love, attention, praise, and rewards from the teachers in her school. The boy's behavior was tolerated for a while, but after a while the teachers became fed up with it and were not sympathetic anymore, and he had a much tougher row to hoe than she did.
Ashley, what expectations about your parenting have had to be adjusted?
Almost all of them. Probably the list runs from A to Z.
Like all of us, probably, too.
I think the biggest one is the fantasy that everything's going to be perfect, that you can do a perfect job and be a perfect mother. All of us end up giving that up eventually because there are no perfect mothers, even in two-parent families. But single mothers, I think, give it up faster and with a bit more of a thud because it's just impossible to be perfect. There are too many stresses and strains on you for you to live up to that level. And frankly, I think the sooner you let that go, the sooner you can get on with the job of doing a good enough job and keeping your head above water instead of killing you and everyone around you trying to be perfect.
Being more comfortable being yourself. Mm-hmm. We'd like to ask both of you, what are some helpful sources of support for children under these circumstances?
Well, my feeling is that you really should look to your school in terms of support. Frequently, there are groups for children who are experiencing the loss of a parent. And also, I think it's very important in terms of the community that you do get your children involved in team sports or team activities or anything that's really local. Because my feeling is the greater the feeling for the child of empowerment, the more control they have over their environment, because they can't control the fact that they're now in a single-parent household. But anything that you can do to enhance their sense of power for themselves and control over what's happening is really critical as far as support is. So anything that will give them a sense of support that they belong, that there's continuity, that everything isn't going to change, those are all sources of support besides family members and extended family and friends.
When you refer to the loss of a parent, I guess you refer both to the death of a parent or the separation or divorce where only one parent is in the household.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Ashley's comments really spoke to that in terms of what she had just brought in. And I wanted to support something that you had said, Ashley, about the idea of being not a perfect parent. I wanted to take that another step further, if that's okay. My feeling is that one of the issues that parents run into is that one isn't enough. Not just that they need to be perfect, but somehow the child is getting cheated somehow. And I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is for the child, is this parent going to be okay with me? Is this parent going to be able to take care of me? Am I going to be protected? Will I lose this parent? You know, if I do something, I mean, it just gets to be a very, very important thing that the parent, be it a single mother or a single father, realize that they have got their limitations, but that this family is as good as this family is going to be because they're going to do the best job they can. And to give the child and themselves a sense of pride in the fact that they're making it.
When you give up the idea of being perfect, it's a very hard thing to do. But one of the benefits that you get along the way, I think, is you manage to get rid of some of the defensiveness at the same time. And I know, for example, sometimes my daughter will lose her temper and just say, "It's not fair. You do a fine job, but I get bored just having one of you around. I would rather be in a house with two parents. And if I were mad at one of them, I could go talk to the other one." And because I've accepted that in some ways, it's easier for me to say, "You're right. It's not fair. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. If I were you, I'd be really ticked off about this too." Instead of taking it as a comment on me and my own inadequacies, because I don't think that's what it is.
What about other grown-ups in the children's lives?
If you're talking to the fact there isn't a male figure in the household, it's wonderful to allow other people to serve that role in some ways, not necessarily being the person in the household. I can understand, and I think it's important to mourn the loss and accept the loss of the other partner and also the other parent. But that's very different because even with one parent, you're getting all the basic qualities that's important in a family. The empathy, the caring, the nurturance, the pride, the loyalty. These are all the qualities that make a good family. If you have those, you have a good family. You may not have that other person right there. And then losing the idea that somehow the child is being deprived or that you may not be able to do a sufficient job as a single parent, I think is one of the critical things. That if you're able to give up that idea and think that I'm doing the best I can, this is the best family this can be, and invariably it's better with a single parent than a family where there are both parents and there's constant conflict.
I think all of us who were brought up in the 40s, 50s, and even early 60s, we're brought up with the notion of the two parents and the two kids, one boy and one girl, in the family car and the dog. And so we've taken this through, and it's been on television and radio and in books and things. And so when things diverge from that in any way, we have to sort of regroup, because I think that's sort of back in our psyches, even though we'd pay lip service to the other stuff. Ashley, what do you think the impact was of the necessity of your changed working hours on your daughter?
My working hours didn't change right away. I was already employed full-time when my husband died, and I kept on working full-time after he died. That was a conscious decision that I made because I was afraid that if I didn't work, that I would sort of emotionally vampirize my child, that I would sort of move in, take over her life, and kind of suck all the blood out of it. It seemed to me to be important to keep working, not just for economic reasons, but for emotional reasons. She was 7 when her father died. I discovered as time went on and she got closer to being a teenager that the long hours I had spent at the office as a litigator, a trial attorney who went to court, had to hop on airplanes, run to parts of the country on a moment's notice, that I personally was not comfortable with continuing to do that as she started to enter junior high. It seems to me that junior high is a pretty critical period and that they need more supervision. You're not necessarily on the spot, but whether from near or afar, you're watching them like a hawk through your binoculars. Mm-hmm. So I decided myself that I needed to change my job and actually work fewer hours rather than more. So I cut back. That was hard for me because it meant giving up a dream in terms of my career. There were things that I had wanted to do, goals that I had set for myself that I had to say now, that's not going to happen. But as time went by, it became obvious to me that this was a choice I was going to have to make one way or another. And looking backwards, I'm happy with the decision I made, even though I'm very aware that it cost.
But you see how you brought out the best in your daughter in the process.
It was worth it.
Now, yeah. Dr. Misalem, what kinds of issues and solutions have you observed with caregiving?
I think that there's a tremendous amount of guilt connected with having a caregiver in there, that somehow, again, there gets to be the notion that you may be shortchanging your child. And I know it's a tremendously difficult task to find the right person. I have seen parents go through numerous caregivers till they found somebody that they felt was appropriate. And there's always the horror with all the stories that one hears now in the news, et cetera, about abuse and, you know, what's happening to your child when you're not there, so that it adds a great deal of weight for the parents that when they're trying to find someone. I think that the most important thing is that there be a mutuality in terms of the feeling that the parent has to be comfortable with the caregiver, first of all, so that they feel that they are transmitting the same kinds of values that they want to have transmitted from themselves. And I just would suggest that people be patient with the process of finding the appropriate person, not to get overly upset when it doesn't happen quickly, that it will happen, you will find them, and that you're doing the best job you can, and not to lose sight of that, because I think it's very easy to get disheartened and feel that sometimes people feel they have to give up their work because they can't be working, and yet emotionally it'll be a drain, not just financially. If they become so selfless in that sense of giving up so much, they become angry. I know for myself, I chose to, as a counselor at that time, work in the school system when I had my two children because I felt that I would have the summers. I mean, I had to make conscious choices as well, Ashley, in terms of how I was going to juggle my career so that I could parent as well as do it. But one of the things I did also was start working on my PhD, so I felt that I had something specifically for myself as well, so I wouldn't feel too angry when I sat there night after night at home. So it's an important thing to find the right person and to be patient with yourself through the process.
Dr. Misalem, what kinds of living arrangements are options for single parents?
Well, you know, there's a lot of living arrangements in terms of even single parents agreeing to co-op, you know, in terms of two parents coming together and saying, hey, you know, maybe we could afford a place together and we can co-op. And then there are such, you know, places as living with your parents, some kind of arrangement where you feel you're getting help and it's not all on you. And I think those are all important. But I have to admit, I'm a little partial to the idea that you be comfortable establishing your own home unit. I think that's one of the key things that we lose sight of. Some people feel so inadequate just doing it on their own that sometimes they're not really sure what they have to give to their child. And I think you lose sight of the fact that what you're giving to the child is yourself and the stability of a relationship and an ongoing process of living together, setting up your own rituals, and having that continuity through the day-by-day living. And so I really think that that would be one of the things I would recommend to people, for them to think about what would make the best home environment for my child and myself, or my children and myself. And the other piece on that I want to say is that when you divorce, frequently parents will try. Say, for example, a mother has felt she was responsible for the total home environment, and then the husband now has a child on their own or children on their own, and she doesn't like the way that parent is parenting. Well, I don't think there's anything more damaging for the children than to have the parents still in conflict as to how the child should be parented. If you've divorced, you have agreed to separate and to establish separate households. And it's important to remember that factor and to be sure that you create the environment you want in your own home. If there are ways you can cooperate and agree with one another, that's something else. But to disagree, to let your child know you don't approve, to let your child know that you're upset with the way their parent is parenting, is absolutely not the way to establish separate households.
What advice do you have?
Well, be aware of your own expectations in terms of how the shift should take place. I don't think most parents, when they're doing that, are aware that they are, in fact, continuing to criticize the other parent. I mean, because there's always this wish, I think, frequently when people divorce and separate, that somehow they'll be able to fix it now that they're away from each other and they don't have to deal with each other directly. But all it does is exacerbate the separations and the differences. And every parent, be it your former husband or your former wife, wants to feel like a good parent. If you are undermining their sense of competency, you are doing your child no good. Remember that in creating an environment, you want to give your child a sense that their parents are good people, unless you know something is dramatically bad and you don't want to, convey that. I'm not suggesting that you accept everything that's going on, carte blanche, but that you think about the fact that, are they well? Are they being clothed properly? Are they nourished? You know, I mean, take the basics and realize that every single parent is struggling with how to juggle time and how to juggle every other aspect, and try to be supportive of one another.
So you're saying basically that you have faith in the child to be able to separate out, when I'm at my father's household, these are the rules. When I'm at my mom's household, these are the rules, and I can live that way.
Right.
In terms of establishing a new order, one of the things we found most helpful was just changing the physical household, that is, getting up and moving after a year during which, that first year during which it seemed a good idea to keep everything as stable as possible. After that, it seemed easier to set up a new life in a new physical home that didn't have the memories and the associations of the old home.
You felt that that helped
good point.
Your daughter to sort of make that change
and start
move
over.
On.
Forward. I felt it helped a lot.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, what tips for organizing your household have been especially helpful?
Well, if you saw my house, you wouldn't ask me that question because I'm no model of organization. But one of the things that I think happens is you find yourself making decisions now in terms of what your fundamental values are. So, for example, knowing that evening times are always crazy, I gave up on the idea of the family dinner. It's just not going to happen. But I substituted for that the family breakfast. In my house, people get out of bed, they put their clothes on, they comb their hair, they come to the breakfast table and sit down and eat breakfast like civilized beings. So at least one time per day, we're all sitting there looking at each other and eating a meal together. It's not the ideal. It's supposed to be at the end of the day. But it's what we do, and it seems to get the day off to a good start.
That was another point I was going to emphasize. You established it physically, but you can also establish new routines and new habits and new rituals, that this is a new unit, that it's not that it's a better or worse unit. It's a new unit, and this is going to be our home together. And I think that's wonderful.
Ashley, how have you dealt with discipline and rules?
Well, two different ways. One is, as I said before, you get down to your fundamental values fairly quickly, and you think, what do I care about and what do I not care about? So things I might once have cared about, like my daughter dyeing her hair purple, all of a sudden don't seem very important anymore. Purple hair? Hey, that's fine with me. Other things in terms of threats to life and limb are more scary, more important than they used to be. And the way I've dealt with that is just to be very frank with my daughter and say, the issue here is not, do I trust you? The issue is, I get scared if you're not home on time. And if you don't phone in, then that's an hour, 2 hours. I'm sitting by the telephone in a state of growing panic, deciding when I should pick up the phone and call the police. And luckily, she is benevolent enough towards me to take that seriously, pick up the phone and call. And we managed to get along fairly well that way.
You've been very honest with her.
Yes.
This is how
said,
I feel, not attacking her.
Right. The issue is me, not you. And This is what it takes to calm me down and make me able to live with. One of the things that's hard to cope with is the constant barrage of negative articles in the newspaper. Every day you pick up the newspaper and say, daughters of single mothers, 47 times more likely to become pregnant. Sons of single mothers, 52 times more likely to use drugs, get zeros on their SAT scores, so on and so forth. After a while, that got so bad, I started cutting them out, putting them on the refrigerator and making a joke of them. And at least in our family, It's worked to have it become a joke. And my daughter will stomp around the house and say, well, I really don't know how I'm going to get my French done if I've got to fit in an axe murdering lesson before I go to class.
Dr. Massalam, what do you advise telling a child when he asks, where's mommy or where's daddy, and dealing with things like loss on days like Mother's Day or Father's Day or special birthdays or something like that?
Well, I always think it's best to tell the child the truth as much as possible. You try to make things available. I mean, in other words, if they learn to call themselves, empower them to do that kind of thing so that they feel that they have some understanding of what's going on. And if it's a special day and you as a parent feel that you may be sad or unhappy, it's wise not to go to a place where there'll be a lot of parents with their children and you're sitting there. Frequently what will happen is that parents feel alienated, particularly if they're not the custodial parent, and they sort of feel, well, if my children really loved me, they'd call me or they'd be there. And the reality is that sometimes a child isn't thinking about that and doesn't really know yet what to do. So it's really important to help them and to help them feel as though that things can go on between the two of you, and not to think of it in terms of a loss, but as creatively as Ashley is, to think of what else can we do that will make this not feel so bad.
One of the things that came as a surprise to me is I thought that the first time we dealt with these issues would do it, and then it would be all over and it would be settled. That, at least in our case, is not what happened. Almost annually, we have to revisit and revisit, and as the child grows up, you tell the story and come back to it all over again at the new level of understanding that they've attained. So it, in a sense, that can be somewhat depressing to contemplate because you realize you're never done. You keep coming back and coming back. You can't just put it in a box and tie it up with a ribbon and a bow. But on the other hand, it means what they don't understand today, they may understand next year or the year after that, and that at some point you can come to a place where the two of you can meet and address these things maybe almost as equals as your child starts growing up and becoming an adult.
What you're saying is eminently important, because you're talking about renegotiating different stages of life and revisiting the loss in a new way, and how do you integrate it into what's going on into your life. Mm-hmm. You're a very wise parent, Ashley.
Ashley and Dr. Massalam, is there anything you'd like to see changed about single parenting?
I have a whole laundry list, but I'll pick two. The first is I'd like to see the social disapproval go away, because the job is hard enough without people sort of flagellating you with whips in the town square for having been a bad person. What you need from other people is support. And the other thing is, I would like to see us do more economically to help families that didn't have the resources that my family did. Because a lot of the things that you need, like counseling and so on, you have to buy, and it takes money for that.
Yeah, I think that's a really important piece that you mentioned about the whole issue of finances. And actually, the research has indicated when there is less impact in terms of the financial status of the family changing, that it's usually more stable for the child, period. A single parent is not a broken home, or it's not a lacking home. That whole notion that there has to be a certain configuration of a family, that needs to change dramatically. And the other thing is to include rituals, to make your own rituals as a way of supporting yourself. I know that one of the things I did with my children was, when the first New Year's Eve, I had filet mignon. And I said, are we going to eat well tonight? And that means we'll eat well all year. Now, my son was, I think, at 8 and a half, or he would have been 9 the next year. And so that the next year, and that was my younger son, my older son would have been 12. And we're sitting down to our second annual filet mignon New Year's Eve dinner. And my youngest son said, we made it, didn't we, Mom? And I hadn't asked him a word.
Oh, wow.
So you don't know, I mean, what you're doing and what you're laying down for your children.
Well, we wish we had more time. This has been wonderful. There have been many, many insights here, and all our listeners should be a lot richer for it. We'd like to thank our guests, Ashley Daugherty and Dr. Venus Massalam, for so much that you've given to everybody. We have a new gift for a special listener, an autographed copy of Dr. T. Barry Brazelton's book for children, Going to the Doctor, will be a special gift to caller number 4 for our parents' listeners' poll. To answer today's question, coming up next, please call us at 1-800-791-8573 and give us your response. What do you find most difficult about raising children? That's 1-800-791-8573. We'd like to send you Dr. Brazelton's book and to use some of your comments on the air. So please leave your name and phone number if you'd like us to call you back.
If you have other comments, questions, or suggestions for Parents Perspective, you can use the toll-free number 1-800-791-8573 or email us at parentspr@aol.com or contact us care of this station. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.